Okay, welcome back. Glad to have you here again. We're continuing this novice teacher training track, and we are this time looking at the book, The Seven Laws of Teaching. This class's purpose is probably twofold. The one is I want to just give somewhat of a book report, albeit a little bit longer than an oral book report of which your students in 7th or 8th grade give. We're going to spend the entire class period here talking about this book. That's the one purpose. The other is that there's just a lot of good content in here that if you can work into your teaching, you will be a successful teacher. Now, isn't that nice? This book, the content of it is very simple, as I will explain and as you will see and as I will read a few excerpts from it along the way. It's not a complex book, but it does take you places and that are further away than what you might think. It's a deep book. This book has a fascinating history. It was first published in 1884. It's a classic. That belongs in your first blank there. It's a classic. And what makes a classic a classic? Well, a classic sort of serves as a standard of excellence. That's your second blank. This book serves as a standard of excellence for many, many other teacher training books. There's a lot of books out there you can get about teaching school, but this sort of serves as a standard of excellence. It's traditional, and it is enduring. I mean, 1884 is a long time to be around, is it not, folks? It really is, in the day of many books. It was published originally, like I said, in 1884, but around 1917, two of John Milton Gregory's students thought, this is really a great work. We can make it even better. And what they did is they sanitized it. Now, when you sanitize something, you don't do what these guys did, but this is what they did. They went through and they pulled out all the references to Christ and Scripture and the Bible. They said, we can make this book more acceptable to the masses if we don't have these offensive portions in it. And the original work got shelved. They had a wonderful marketing program, and the book got mass marketed. It got mass marketed that long in its sanitized edition that when I was first introduced to it in about 1996, guess which version I was introduced to? The sanitized version. But I didn't know that, and neither did many other people know it until the year 2004. All of a sudden, somebody somewhere found the unabridged original. And I was like, whoa, this book was good, it's even better. There's a school in Moscow, Idaho, Logos something, that used this as one of their core textbooks for a teacher training program. They have promoted the book for quite some time over the years, and imagine their surprise when they realize they're a Christian school, when they realize that there's actually a better version available. And so, if you go to buy The Seven Laws of Teaching, do get the unabridged, and I would recommend the Veritas Press edition. I think there may be another publisher now that is publishing the unabridged version, but you do not want the sanitized version. They were two of John Milton Gregory's students. I find that just sort of an unusual twist that they respected his work, but yet they sort of destroyed its potency. Yeah. Just briefly, my personal testimony with this book, I think I was first introduced to it in 1996 or something like that, near the beginning of my teaching. I kept on studying it and studying it and studying it and studying it. In about 2000, I don't know what it was, about 2008 or something like that, I got this book, and my book used to look like the one that you have. CLE, Christian Light Education, did ask if I would write a study guide for the book for their teacher training level 2. And so that is still continuing to be revised. They didn't actually print it in a final form. It is being field tested still. But that does offer a kind of an Anabaptist stance study guide for this book. And I think that it's a beneficial thing to study this book because there's so many profound truths here. One summer, while this course was in development for CLE,
I hosted or facilitated a conference call where at a given time of the week, 10 teachers would come online and we'd talk about the seven laws of teaching. We went all summer and got to about Law 5. And it was rich. It was wonderful. Right, the premise of this book, the basic premise is that overarching laws govern all worthwhile endeavors. So in other words, if you're a carpenter, there are going to be some laws that govern your trade. It's going to be the law of the wood, we could say. There's some wood that just works better for framing a house than others. Building cabinets. If you're going to be a kitchen man, have a cabinet shop, there's going to be some laws there. You know, the law of the whatever, and the whatever and the whatever. The finish, and the countertop, and whatnot. But the premise is that overarching laws govern all worthwhile endeavors. And then secondly, point B on your outline is that observation and study of those laws creates skill in the work. So if we can understand the laws that govern a particular endeavor, why then it engenders skill. I'm not much of a seamstress. And I never will be a seamstress because, frankly, I'm not interested in the laws of a seamstress. I'm just not going to go there. But if you're going to be a good seamstress, you're going to need to know the law of the whatever. You're going to have to know about the fabric. You're going to have to know about the thread, the stitch, the this, the that, the other thing. Right? I have this niggling thing, too. I don't know if I'm going to be a seamstress as a male. What do you call a... Seamster? Taylor, thank you. There's a better word yet. All right. So it's not that we can't have enthusiasm without skill. Matter of fact, we can have a lot of enthusiasm without skill. Think of the little five-year-old that just learned how to ride a bike. They can have plenty of enthusiasm for pedaling that bike down the hill. They can really go places. They got lots of enthusiasm, but they don't have the skill yet. So that demonstrates and points out the fact that it's much better if our enthusiasm is based in skill rather than having enthusiasm without skill. This book will aid you in your enthusiasm for teaching on a skill basis. Skill-based enthusiasm, it's much better than the second blank there that I had in mind, the word emotional-based enthusiasm. It's fine, it's wonderful to get pumped up about our studies and get excited about them. But skill-based enthusiasm is always going to be better than emotional-based enthusiasm. This is actually one of the principles of the book. This is not something I'm telling you off on my own. I'm telling you this out of the content of the book. Now, a word yet about the seven laws of teaching being enabling and not restrictive. When I first encountered this, I was like, seven laws? Laws of teaching? I don't think that the teaching is very law-based. I mean, look at the varying personalities in this small room alone and how all these different personalities can actually be successful teachers, and you're going to say you're going to apply law to this? And I just didn't really, I felt that law was hampering, it was restricting, it was not enabling. It turns out that anybody, regardless of the personality, regardless of the venue, the format of the classroom, and all this sort of stuff, if there's going to be effective exchange between student and learner, it's going to follow these laws. In the same way that you're going to get thunked on the head by an apple if you sit under an apple tree long enough, regardless of whether or not you understand the laws of gravity. It's just going to happen. It's going to be one of those things. And so these things become maybe could say somewhat like an axiom. An axiom is a very basic statement, so basic it's accepted without proof. And that's why these laws present very simply, because they're almost like axioms. And that we go, as I've learned to do from my school students, duh. All right? But it turns out that there's a whole lot more beyond that than what you would just see on the surface. So do not look at this with suspicion that we look at law. Law, yeah, I know about law. No, that's not the attitude. All right, let's go to the content of the book. Are there any questions up to this point or comments? I suppose you found the correct side of the handout. Okay. I thought you were intelligent people. I do want to have just a few words yet about the author, if you'd indulge me just a little bit. John Milton Gregory, does that name sound familiar at all? Any part of it? John Milton, the blind poet, who wrote Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained, the book-length poems. All right. He also wrote the poem, perhaps more familiar to you, On Blindness. If you had the CLE literature book, there's a poem on blindness. That he was a blind poet. John Milton Gregory's parents obviously had a regard for John Milton, the poet. And he was, John Milton Gregory was named after John Milton, born in 1822. He began teaching school when he was 17 years old in 1839. He became a superintendent of a school in Detroit, Michigan when he was 30 years old in 1852. In 1854, 2 years later, he founded the Michigan Journal of Education. In 1858, now 36 years old, he was elected to state superintendent of public schools in Michigan. This man is not small potatoes. But as his work in superintendency became more involving, he realized this is not for me. I'm not a school administrator. I am a teacher. And so he went to work at the Kalamazoo, Michigan College as a, you guessed it, a teacher. Hang up the administration coat, put on the teacher hat again as a 41-year-old. As a 45-year-old, he started the Illinois State University. And that's where he remained for the next 13 years. He served on many educational boards, wrote several books in his retirement, including this one, 1884. He died when he was 76 years old and asked to be buried in the University of Illinois, the college that he had founded, and his wish was honored. He considered that college the greatest service of his life, but we now know that it was likely this book. All right, to the content. The first chapter of this book establishes some of the facts that we already went across about the idea of skill-based enthusiasm being better than enthusiasm, emotional enthusiasm. It goes across the idea of laws and how all worthwhile human endeavor is guided by law. Another thing he goes across that we should say yet before we get into the laws themselves is he believes in what he calls the absolutist approach of teaching. In other words, there are, yes, laws that govern teaching. And it's not a nebulous, squishy, hard-to-be-cornered subject. Pedagogy is actually something that can be learned, it can be taught, it can be observed. You can write about it. It's not about, whatever, black holes. It's not about some of this other, you know, sort of nebulous phenomena. An absolutist approach means that there are ways that if we do it, and if we honor these ways and principles, then we'll have success. And there's many different personalities and many different ways that these specifics actually, you know, come out in a classroom, but there are some irreducible principles that we must honor these principles, otherwise teaching and learning never happen. All right, so to the second chapter, which is the first law, the law of the teacher. The teacher must be the one who knows the lesson or truth to be taught. Basically, what this is saying, if you're going to teach, you must know. Right? Could I have some brave volunteers here? Would two people on this side of the room and two people on this side of the room stand up if you know what a PB&J sandwich is? All right. Okay, fine. We have four standing. Just remain standing, please. Your bravery is still needed. All right. So in the back, Jesse, could you explain what do you know a PB&J sandwich to be?
Something you gain.
Do you know that? All right, but you must also love the material which you teach. You're out. What's a PB&J sandwich?
It's that for peanut butter and jelly.
Peanut butter and jelly? All right, so you may be seated. Between the two that remain standing, would you please tell us, what does it take to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? One at a time.
Bread.
Bread?
Jelly. Peanut butter.
You going to put it on with your finger?
A knife?
A knife? All right. Okay. You may be seated. Could they come forward now and explain how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? Yes? Well, I think so. I think everyone in this room now could give a demonstration how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich because you're in the know, right? This is what this law is saying. All right. Four more volunteers. Let's see if we can do it better this time. Two from this side and two from this side. Brave people, please stand up. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right, that's sufficient. All right. Are you ready to make us some Petersky? Jordan. Petersky? Petersky. Sit down. Davey, Petersky? No. Heidi, Petersky? We don't know. All right. I'll tell you what it takes to make Petersky. I taught at a Russian school, and what it takes, I thought maybe you were from Ukraine. No, that's your cousin. It takes having mashed potatoes the day before, so you have some leftovers. And then it takes dough, like a donut, and then I don't know what all it takes, but after I have something that looks like a donut that's full of yesterday's mashed potatoes, and there you have it, Petersky. All right? See, now you know. All right? Sort of, kind of. The point is simply this, that the teacher must be the one who knows the lesson or truth to be taught. You have to study if you're going to be a teacher. Study long enough that you don't have to lean so heavily on the teacher's guide that all you can do is read out of it. Okay? That level of knowledge, at least, is needed to be an effective teacher. Stay ahead of your students. You must stay ahead of your students. As a first-year teacher, I did very poorly in language when I was a scholar. It's not that my grades were so terrible, but I spent a lot of time figuring out what was the least amount of work I had to engage myself in to get through. And so if I would have put that much energy into just understanding the lesson, I would have got much better grades and everybody would have been happier, including me. So then it comes time that I'm supposed to teach this stuff. My first assignment as a teacher was teaching grades 7 to 10 in a multi-grade classroom, which amounted to 3, I believe, different English classes. 9 and 10 were using the same material. Every day, I stayed one day ahead of the students. Just one. Every day, I figured if I could get prepared for my language classes in less than an hour, why, things were really moving. Usually, it was more like an hour and a half. And if I'm going to be the teacher, I had to know this stuff, right? And because I stayed one day ahead of my students in knowledge, I was indeed able to teach them English, sort of, kind of. But I wouldn't have even been able to do it sort of, kind of, if I didn't prepare, right? This whole rule is all about preparation, is it not? It really is. Let me read to you a section from this book. Notice the lofty language as I read. I'm just picking out a section from this chapter, and I'll explain a little bit more why. Do not deny yourself the help of good books on the subject of the lesson. Buy, borrow, or beg if necessary, but get the help of the best scholars and thinkers, enough at least to set your own thoughts going, but do not read without deep and original thinking. If possible, talk your lesson over with an intelligent friend. Collision often brings light. In the absence of these aids, write your views. The nib of the pen digs deep into the minds of truth. Expressing thought often clears itself of its dross and obscurities. Right? He's obviously developing Law 1, is he not? But did you catch the lofty language? You kind of get the tone of the book in the reading of that section. Whatever it takes to get in the know, we have to do. And there's a tremendous amount of resources out there that are available for us to understand the lesson or the truth to be taught. One year, in order to be a more effective teacher, I honored Law 1 by doing pretty much every one of the student exercises in the algebra course that I was teaching, because I needed to know what I was going to teach. All right, Law 2 is the law of the learner. The learner is the one who attends with interest to the lesson. What makes a student a student? Well, interest. Interest. So then it behooves us as teachers to be interesting. Thank you. Thank you. And, you know, you can't change another person's, the reality of their mind. Or can you? It's a question to think about. Students would rather drink from a fountain than a stagnant puddle, right? And so we honor law, too, when we present our stuff in an interesting way so that there isn't lagging boredom. See, someone has said that if there's someone sleeping in church, the usher ought to have a long, sharp stick with which to poke the
preacher.
Yeah. Right? That's based on this law. Okay? So, it is true that we can't say, that preacher can't say when his parishioners go to bed the night before and so forth. And that kind of thing happens at school sometimes too. But the learner must attend with interest to the lesson. See, what are the three requirements of any learner? Is curiosity. Curiosity is what we're talking about, right? If you have no curiosity about it, that's another reason I'll never be a tailor. I don't even have any curiosity about it, really. I just want clean clothes, that's all. And courage and honesty. You have those three things, you know, a student, you can go places with them. But curiosity. So stir their curiosity. Appeal to their curiosity. So how do we get the student's mind engaged? Well, I think a great way, and this book talks about, is start the class with a question. He says in here that a teacher has 2 seconds to secure the attention of his class. 2 seconds. If that's true, we need to get on the ball, right? We need to get things rolling rather quickly. But you can use your students for a tremendous amount of the work and the exchange that you have in a classroom. You can start a class and say, all right, that you're going to check your math there. So what lesson is it, Jeremy, that we're checking your math today? Lesson 48. But it's lesson 48, starting with number one there. Let's see, anybody, before we start, what was the assignment? And Mr. Garber said, blah, 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 right? You can get the students, get that exchange going. Let's just do a real quick math problem here. And let's start here with Luke. 3 plus 2 is 5. Jeremy, next. 9 and 4 is?
3.
Write the 3. Tally the?
1.
1, right. And then?
6.
6. And how did you get the 6?
Add a 1 plus
2. You get the point. Okay, point made. Involve the students. Get them there. Keep them on their toes with your teaching. Appeal to their interests. That's another great way. I had a boy in school in the 7th grade that it just wasn't going so well between him and me. He was kind of withdrawn, and I really wanted to see him blossom, and he just wasn't blossoming really at all. He hadn't blossomed for 7 years, truth to be told. And I knew along the way that he had interest in fixing diesel engines. And so I really am not a mechanic. But I subscribed to Diesel Progress, which was a magazine that I knew he enjoyed. And I'll never forget the look on his face at lunchtime when he was just ready to bite into his sandwich. And I just sort of mentioned casually that I read in Diesel Progress that I don't know if he ever ate that sandwich. Right. But it was because it was appealing to his interests. And it was because of that through that whole thing, I was able to develop a very, very meaningful relationship with him. And we were able to go places in the classroom, both in academics and character development. That's a whole other story. Another thing that we need to do to honor the law of the learner is deal with distractions. So there is distractions. And so you have this student that persists in this, and you've given him the no, shaking of the head, and he stops. And then you look the next place, and he's back at it again. And that time you give him the look, you know? And so it stops again. You know, those things can really, really be annoying, right? And you're just going to have to address that. You're going to have to tell him, sorry, Tom, you've got some awesome rhythm there, but maybe you ought to do that on your legs so the rest of us aren't distracted, right? You're going to have to deal with it somehow, right? What would you do? What should I do as a teacher if a helicopter... Let's just suppose that helicopters have an engine problem and it's landing in the field right out there. What should I do?
Go out and look at it. Crowd the window, folks. Immediately. Right?
Work sensibly with distraction. The book explains the varying degrees of interest. I'm spending too much time on these laws. Some of them we're going to have to go over more quickly. The varying levels of interest. The one is just flitting interest, kind of like, oh, I see you have a brown striped dress on, sorry, checked, or whatever. I noticed I'm not just super interested in it, right? That's flitting interest. But it goes from flitting the whole way to totally absorbed, to self-sustaining, almost perpetual interest. All. My dad's a pastor, a preacher, and one of his stories that he likes to tell is when he was preaching, he noticed that one of the people, one of the dads, was sitting there holding a toddler on his lap, and the toddler had a little Tupperware container that he was slowly eating Cheerios. And when the toddler would get squirmy, why, the dad would help him get going with the Cheerios again. And my dad kept on preaching. And after a while, he noticed that the dad was eating the Cheerios. Right? But he wasn't at all offended by it. In fact, he was flattered by it. You know why, right? Because that man was totally absorbed in the lesson, in the sermon, and it was an honor to the preacher. So you want to honor your preacher? Let's think of another one. Another way to honor the law of the learner, the very important principle, I think of this so often, and that is, plant seeds, not plants. Sow seeds, not plants. That's the idea. If we become hyper with the law of the teacher and think that we have to explain every bit of the lesson, and we chew this food up, and maybe even do the pigeon thing where they're regurgitating, you know, the lesson, you're going to turn off your students. You need to appeal to their interest. They do have intelligent minds, and they want to use them. They need to use them. And we can't spoon feed our students. Otherwise, we violate the law of the learner. We actually mess up with their interest. All right, another part way we honor the law of the learner is knowing when to move on. So we move on now to the law of the language. The law of the language says, the language used as a medium between teacher and learner must be common to both. Common to both. And this is meaning more that if I'm going to be teaching Russian students, either I have to understand Russian or they need to understand English. It actually is not really talking about having the same family of languages. It's talking about using terms that can be understood, right? Let me illustrate. There was a, when I taught at the Russian school, they did their language, English was a second language. In the big picture, they had more language than I did, but it just happened to be in two different camps, and so it produced that little problem, you know. And so I didn't require them to look up every word in the dictionary, otherwise they would have, you know, got calloused from the dictionary. One of the students asked me one time when she was doing her English lesson, her language lesson, she said, "What does frisking mean?" I said, "Well, tell me a little more about it." Well, she said, "Does it mean like pat down?" I said, "You mean like a pat down at the airport?" I said, "Yeah, yeah." So that's what, yeah, frisking can mean that. Well, she said, would frisking down be okay? Well, yeah, it might be. I'm not sure if I've heard it that way before, but yeah, pat down. And she said, "Well, then what does this sentence mean? Two lambs were frisking down in the meadow." You know, right over the top. If we're going to teach, we have to teach in terms that are understood, right? So beware of those large words. You might know what the word incentive means, for instance, which I talked about that a little bit earlier, gave an illustration, but your fifth grader might have no clue what the word incentive means. So you're not teaching them anything to be using the word incentive. Your similes and metaphors are wonderful things because we're using words and situations and concepts that they understand to move them from point A to point B to actually communicate the new truth or the new skill, whatever.
that's why similes and metaphors are so good. And that's, again, it's why stories are so good, right? Because people assuming they understand the story. And children love stories. And oftentimes because they love stories because they can understand them. And that's why Jesus told stories. You see what's happening here. What grade level would understand this implied meaning or this... Well, I guess what I'm trying to say here is that we can use even concepts that we lose our students. For instance, how many of you understand, just think about it a little bit, then I'm going to ask you to raise your hand. If you understand this phrase, there are no atheists in foxholes. Just go ahead and give me the thumbs up if you understand what's going on there. Okay? I didn't expect everybody to understand that. We know what an atheist is, but you got to know what a foxhole is too. A foxhole is out, I think, of World War II, World War I, out on the battlefield. If you don't want to get hit, you dig in, right? And that little hole that you dug in the ground with whatever was available, maybe your helmet is what you used to dig your hole. Because this is a life and death situation, you see? Now do you understand there are no atheists in foxholes, right? I read a quote not so long ago that said, all this buttoning and unbuttoning. You get that? Understand? How many understand that? All this buttoning and unbuttoning. Yes, me understand. I don't think anybody should raise their hand, really. All right? Because you have to understand the context. Here was the context. That was a suicide note. Now you understand. I still don't get it. Right? How could that be? Well, it was back in the days before shoelaces. Right? See, now it's starting to get some context. This was a man who had despaired of life. And he basically said, I'm tired of living. We have to understand where our students are in their understanding so that the language that we're using actually says something. There must be a common medium. Otherwise, the bridge just won't connect. You know, the bridge between me and the student. Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to Law 4. Law 4. Yeah, we're talking about the law of the language. All right, these kind of build on each other. Law 4 is the law of the lesson. The lesson to be mastered must be explicable in terms of truth already known by the learner. The unknown must be explained by means of the known. I actually probably merged these two more than I should have. It's too easy to do that at this point, and I apologize for that. When the first men walked on the moon back in, 67, I believe, I think. Anyway, when they first walked on the moon, they actually played like little boys in the moon dust. And Neil Armstrong had a glove full of it, and Neil Armstrong's buddy, obviously, I don't know who he was, he had a handful of it, and they were pouring this back and forth in their hands, and I mean, this was something they had never experienced before, right? This was obviously the unknown. And the one said, and this is International Archives, the one said, this reminds me of Portland cement. And the other one said, I was going to say baby powder. But that illustrates this law perfectly. The unknown must be explained in terms of the known. See it? And there they were in an other world. They went back to the known world to explain the otherworldly phenomena. Right? So if we're going to lead our students along, we have to start with where they are. And that's why it's so important that if we're going to teach a skill-based lesson, such as in math and language, why we have to understand what skills are required. If we're going to teach them how to do division of fractions, they jolly well better understand pretty good the multiplication of fractions, right? And so there's a great place to start your lesson. Start teaching the multiplication of fractions as review where they have known knowledge, and then we take a step forward
into the division of fractions and introduced the idea of a reciprocal, right? So the law, the lesson is saying you just have to start where they are and move on. And it seems to me that this is probably something we need to be thinking about when we'd really like to pass a student at the end of the year, but we'd really like them to keep up their peers, and they'd really like to keep up their peers, and their parents would really, really like them to keep up with their peers. Folks, we're judging by the wrong standard here, aren't we? Right? When we decide to move a student on to promote them to the next grade, if they don't have the skills required to support the next grade, guess what's going to happen in the next grade? More trouble, right? You certainly get the concept, right? Sometimes we need to do remedial work, right? Where we need to go back and we need to pick up and try to see where did we lose them. And sometimes students are coming into your school, and because we don't know exactly where they are, it behooves us to give. There's diagnostic tests that most publishers have available. You can give them a diagnostic test where it actually quantifies. Here's their knowledge. Here's areas you might need to go back on. Here's areas that might cause problems. Or maybe they just simply don't have enough to go into the grade you'd like to put them into. That's the law of the lesson. All right, let's go to the law of the teaching process. Teaching is arousing, law 5, and using the pupil's mind to grasp the desired thought or to master the desired art. Right? Now, this sounds a lot like the ones that we had talked about up in Law 1 and Law 2. Law 1 and Law 2 talk more about what the teacher is and what the learner, who the learner is. Now in Law 5 and 6, we're talking more about what the teacher does and what the learner does. A little bit of a difference there. Teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind to grasp the desired thought. I'm going to read again from this book, page 100. Again, notice the language. Thus far, we have considered teaching as a communication of knowledge, but this defines the act by its results. Whether by telling, showing, explaining, or setting lessons, the teacher seems to communicate knowledge. But there is a deeper and truer view of the teacher's work, a profounder and more philosophical explanation of its function. Behind and beyond all the telling, explaining, lesson giving, there lies, as the central aim of it all, and of all that the teacher does, the awakening and setting in action the learner's mind, the arousing of his self-activities, as they have been called, those faculties of cognition, imagination, and reasoning, whose action must always be voluntary and self-impelled. Right? Where to go with this? The only one working is the only one learning. The only one thinking is the only one learning. If we're not getting our students to think, it may have been a wonderful day for you as a teacher as far as the fun you had upstairs here, right? But as far as how far it got the students, it didn't take them down the road of learning at all, because we must arouse and use the pupil's mind to make this happen. What do we call the things that we want students to think about? Well, we call them concepts. What do we call the process of something taking hold inside? We call it conception. Right? These things are all an internal function. So how do we honor this? I think we've been talking about it, but how do we promote it? Well, reward student thinking. There's just nothing better that happens in classrooms than when a student comes and says, "Mr. Jonathan, you know how we studied in math yesterday that if whatever it was," and they say, "I did that last night." Right there, stop everything and have them give a report and say, "Class, Billy went home and he read his electric meter. Yesterday we had that lesson on reading electric meters. He did it. Billy, can you tell us about it?" "Well, yeah, I just went
the right things are happening at that point, right? Of course they are. That's arousing the student mind. And what you might do, if a student uses a vocabulary word, like I was really intrigued one day with the word brouhaha. A few days later, one of my students used the word brouhaha. Stop. Yay, right? I gave him 5% extra credit on his spelling lesson for the next week on the spot. All right? Why? Because that's good stuff, right? Because the right thing's happening. But that affects his grade on his report card? Yes, it literally did affect his grade on the report card. Uh-huh. He was learning. All right? Go on. The law of the learning process, and this is the flip side of this whole coin. Learning is thinking into one's own understanding a new idea or truth or working into habit, a new art or skill. Thinking into one's own understanding. Learning is getting that reproduced in the student's mind, as we were talking about. So yes, we reward student thinking. A lot of this, folks, a lot of this happens in the doing of a thing. What does John 17:17 say? If any man will what his will, he shall know the doctrine. If any man will do his will, he shall know the doctrine. All right? So yeah, we learn by doing. So we have students doing their math work. We have them doing problems in math and picking out adjectives and so on. Now the law of review and application. The test or proof, those are the two words for the blank. The test or proof of teaching done, the finishing and fastening process, must be a reviewing, rethinking. I bet you know what goes in the rest of the blanks, right?
Yeah.
Re-knowing, reproducing, reapplying of the material that has been taught, the knowledge and ideals and arts that have been communicated. Most of us, especially as we begin teaching, we sort of diminish the importance of review, and we think it's not very necessary. Something you do if you have time. I propose that if we never had to do review in school at all, we could get 10 years of learning into one. If you only had to tell them once, and all they had to say is once, it adds an apple, you know. I think we could get 10 years into one. So review is just about that important. Don't skip the review. The review is actually part of the learning process, which is why curriculum developers came up with the whole spiral method of curriculum development and curriculum design. So again, lead into the lesson with review. Work review into your teaching. And folks, that's about it. I'm not sure. Matt isn't in the class, which is fine. He spent 4 days last week. Not Matt. Here we go again. Davey Petersheim studying this book. And he basically said at the end of the study he felt like he didn't get it all. Right. Again, if you want this book, if you want a copy of it, $11. There's about 11 of them available. Any questions? Any comments? Class is closed.